In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Warning, Check the Locks podcast is a true crime podcast and may contain graphic descriptions of violence, murder, sexual assault, and more. Check the Locks podcast is not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Welcome back to Check the Locks podcast. As always, I'm John Connor.
I'm Olivia Cornu.
Saying thank you for joining us this week as we dive into yet another truly terrifying true crime case. Before we get started, as always, Olivia, my Colorado-bound friend, how are you? How's your week been? What you been up to?
Oh, you know, just out here in Colorado doing a little snow skiing with my friends. Nothing too exciting. Just trying to, you know, keep the podcast going.
That's awesome. What about you? Oh, you know, just been working, getting through the week and trying to dodge this crazy weather we've been getting, stuff like that. So making it happen, but I'm glad that you're having a good time. You're getting to spend some time with friends. And this week is your case. So, you know, I know you are there, you're hanging out, you're doing schoolwork, spending time with friends, doing all sorts of stuff. So should we just jump into this week's case, kind of break it down, stop it with that Gabby Gabby, hit him with the stabby stabby, just jump on into it?
Yeah, let's do it. And forgive me, I'm still, you know, got this sinus issue happening.
Yeah, same here. Oh, also, I did want to say thank you to anybody who donated for Hogs to the Cause.
Hogs to the Cause.
Yeah, this episode is going to come out Monday. So if you donated before this last Saturday, just know it's greatly appreciated. And want to let you know we truly do appreciate it. So thank you so much for doing something for a good cause. But with that, I digress. Olivia, I will let you go ahead and break it on down.
Well, for nearly a decade, the city of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, harbored a monster hidden in plain sight. Between 1994 and 2004, a series of brutal unsolved murders plagued the region. Each one became more disturbing than the last. Now, John, remember we did Derek Todd Lee as one of our first episodes, who was another Baton Rouge serial killer.
I do. It was one like our very first episodes. It was like, I want to say like one of the first five, I think, that we did.
Yeah, so this one kind of gets a little close to that one. So just if you haven't listened to that one, go back and check and listen to the Derek Todd Lee episode and praise us of our progression of our podcast.
Yes, yeah, we were too fresh-faced trying to figure it out as we went along. So yes, it's a very long time ago.
Well, on March 21st, 1994, 81-year-old Ann Bryan was attacked in the comfort of her upscale retirement home after leaving her door open for her nurse to come check on her. What began as an attempted assault quickly turned into a nightmare. Her throat was slashed and she was stabbed repeatedly with such ferocity that she was nearly decapitated and disemboweled. The case shook the community, but without clear leads, it eventually went cold. For years, nothing seemed to follow. But in January of 1999, the killings resumed. The second known victim, Catherine Hall, a local sex worker. She was lured into a vehicle with the promise of oral sex, only to be attacked with a zip tie and an attempted strangulation. When she fought back, she was stabbed to death. Her killer then undressed and mutilated her body. This marked a gruesome escalation in the killer's crimes. Just months later, in the spring of 1999, a jogger named Hardy Schmidt was stalked for weeks before strangely being struck by a vehicle. The driver then dragged her into a ditch, and she was bound with a zip tie, raped, and murdered. Police would learn that Hardy's body was stored in the back of a truck for 2 days. Only later, her remains would be dumped in a remote bayou off Highway 61 in St. James Parish. But the violence didn't stop there. On November 12th of that same year, another woman, Joyce Williams, was murdered. This time she was brought back to the killer's home. There, her body was mutilated, and in a sickening twist, parts of her were cannibalized. Her remains weren't discovered until January of 2000. Now, between 2000 and 2003, at least three more women were killed, each bearing the same hallmarks: strangulation, mutilation, and post-mortem desecration. These cases emerged during the same period when another serial killer who we covered, Derek Todd Lee, was also active in Baton Rouge. His arrest in 2003 sparked a wave of relief, but also confusion. Some of the unsolved murders didn't match his MO, leading authorities to fear that another predator was still at large. Then, on February 26, 2004, 43-year-old Donna Johnston became the killer's final known victim. After murdering her, the assailant took 45 photographs of her body, then transported and posed it at separate locations before dumping it. It was the killer's most brazen act yet. The discovery of tire tracks at Johnston's dump site led investigators to a break. The tracks were traced to a specific tire model, and in April 2004, authorities interviewed vehicle owners who matched the criteria. Among them was a man living quietly in Baton Rouge. Investigators obtained DNA samples from all the vehicle owners. Shortly after, detectives would get a match. On April 29, 2004, Sean Vincent Gillis was arrested in front of his longtime girlfriend. He offered no resistance, only apologizing to her as he was taken into custody. Now, that same day, he confessed. Inside Gillis's home, detectives uncovered a chilling trove of evidence: photographs of victims, computer files filled with violent pornography, and an entire folder labeled DTL, which contained news clippings about Derek Todd Lee. Gillis admitted that he admired Lee and feared being, quote, outdone by him. He used the notoriety of another killer as fuel for his own twisted crimes. Gillis was not the violent madman people might have imagined. To outsiders, he was quiet, even unremarkable. He lived with his girlfriend Terry, who had long suspected his obsession with pornography, but had no idea of its graphic, violent nature. She told police that he showed her disturbing images of a dead woman, but she dismissed them, unaware of the true danger that lived beside her. Gillis's early life had its own share of turmoil. He was born June 24, 1962. He was raised by his mother, Yvonne. His father, an alcoholic who had mental illness, left the family after a violent breakdown. Despite that, Sean had a relatively normal upbringing. He attended Catholic school and maintained a close relationship with his mother and grandparents. But in his teenage years, dark interests began to surface. Alongside two friends, he dabbled in satanic rituals, smoked marijuana, and developed an early fascination with violence. As an adult, Gillis floated from job to job. He eventually found solace behind a computer screen. There, he descended into a world of violent, misogynistic pornography that fed his growing fantasies. Though he gained computer certifications, he neglected work, friends, and reality, spending hours obsessively viewing and collecting graphic content. He began dating Terry, and the relationship continued despite these warning signs. Gillis appeared as a mild-mannered yet eccentric boyfriend, all while stalking, abducting, and murdering women in secret. Following his confession, Gillis was charged with the murders of Catherine Hall, Johnny Williams, and Donna Johnston. He was also charged with three counts of ritualistic acts. As the investigation progressed, prosecutors built a case against Gillis for eight murders committed between 1994 and 2004. His trial began in July of 2008, and it showcased compelling evidence such as photographs and confessions from Gillis himself. Prosecutors introduced DNA evidence, testimonies from the victims, and described Gillis' method of operation. In contrast, the defense team requested leniency, highlighting his collaboration with authorities post-arrest. He was found guilty on all counts and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The jury was deadlocked on the death penalty. And in August of 2007, he pled guilty to the murders of Joyce Williams and Marilyn Nevels. This added two additional life sentences. He is currently serving his time at Angola State Penitentiary in Louisiana. So that's this week's case. What you think?
Man, this is, I feel like Derek Todd Lee and someone like Gillis are some of like the last serial killers as we know them, right? Like that multiple victims getting away with it. Like they were right on that line where technology just wasn't where it is now.
Yeah.
And you could use somebody else. Cause now it's like, yeah, we're finding these victims, but we can test DNA so quickly that it'd be very easy to tell that it's two different people.
Right.
But this is just straddling that line where it just wasn't quite there yet.
Mm-hmm. And they were able to do these terrible things and get away with it.
Yeah. And use, you know, somebody else's crimes to be like, oh, this gives me a way to go out and do what I want to do and potentially, you know, blame it on somebody else. And then to have that like competitive, you know, I don't want him to be a better killer than me. You know, this is like straight throwback to, you know, almost like a 70s kind of vibe. You know what I mean? So it's very strange.
Yeah. And I don't, somebody had sent me this case, one of our listeners and someone that I work with, shout out Ashley. But so I kind of thought it was familiar and I wasn't sure if we've done it, but I was like, it just seems so bizarre and just crazy that it was happening the same time that somebody else was murdering in that same area. And that's a big college town. I mean, that's where LSU is. So like, I think I've said it before, like my sister was going to potentially go there. My mom was like, absolutely not. Like there is a mass murderer. There's a serial killer down there. Like I'm not sending you to college there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just so violent and brazen, right? To be like, I'm taking pictures of, you know, 45 photos is a lot of pictures. You know what I mean? And then to have just this kind of treasure trove of evidence against you on your computer, you know, and there's obviously some very deep-seated mental illness somewhere. Because, you know, there's plenty of teenagers who are like, I smoke pot with my friends and look at pornography that don't end up, you know, murdering a handful of women and sharing photos of dead women with their girlfriend. Be like, look at this. You know what I mean? So there's obviously something that was going on below the surface with Gillis, I would suspect, for a very long time. But I'm sure, you know, without the help, without getting proper treatment, you know, you're just left to those dark thoughts. And I think it just goes to show like how important mental health is and, you know, addressing those things before they become something like this, because it's very obvious that he was very, very sick.
Yeah, it's just like, where did it, what goes wrong in someone's life that just makes you feel the need to just brutally murder and almost decapitate and debow someone? Like that is gruesome. And then don't forget the cannibalism.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, what? No, no.
Yeah. I mean, I'm, you know, if you listen to this podcast, you know that neither one of us are professionals, but it feels a lot like I have all the power. Like not only can I take your life away, but like, I'm going to eat you because I can. Because you're less than a human to me. You know what I mean? And it's, you know, I don't know. It's very sad. And I think, too, when you know, going through when you were talking about it, like his father having mental illness and leaving the family after, you know, a violent outburst. It's almost like, yeah, the writing is on the wall. You know, that kind of stuff is genetic. So, you know, if he got a touch of something that his dad was affected by or something of that nature, and again, it goes untreated. You know, somebody who could have been completely, you know, functioning member of society had he gotten the help that he needed, instead, you know, find solace looking at these terrible things online and just dives deeper into that descent of, you know, just terror. Like, I don't know. I don't even know how to explain it. It's just, it sometimes these hit a little hard because like, man, if somebody just would have been like, you need to talk to somebody, lives would have been spared. Maybe this guy had a shot of having a normal life. You know what I mean? So it tends to be sad all the way around.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Just like, what was the trigger? What was the changing point?
Yeah.
You know, because I don't feel like people are just truly born to be this terrible. Maybe they are. Maybe they're not. I don't really know.
Yeah.
Well, if we're putting this on the deadbolt scale, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I think something like this for me would come in at a 9. And I think part of it is just because, you know, I have a wife, I have a mother, I have a daughter. And so the randomness of this, where it's just like I picked victims and I attack them and take their lives from them at random, at will. You know, there's something scary about thinking that there are people out there that are just, you know, hunting is what it is. And, you know, am I worried about something like this for myself? Not extremely, but when I think about the women in my life, it's, you know, it's like, yeah, it's another thing my wife and I were talking about pretty recently, like having a girl and talking about growing up and the fact that, you know, girls get sexualized at a much younger age than boys do. And, you know, you'll see like an 11-year-old girl getting catcalled, you know what I mean? And so just thinking that there are people out there preying on people like that is terrifying. So I think for me, I would definitely put this at a 9. But what about you? Where are you going to put it?
Oh, yeah. You know, all the things you said about being a woman and you having all the women in your life. It's a 9 for me. This is terrifying. This is another one where I am of the demographic that is being attacked. So always scary for me. And the randomness and like just the gruesome, the brutality, the whole thing. It's up there for me.
For sure. Yeah, it's, you know, as a dad and especially having a young daughter, it's just one of those things where it's like, you already have to worry. I'm learning from talking to my wife that the world tends to be much crueler to women than men, especially in those adolescent. Like, not only are boys, can they be very rude? And then you have to worry about, again, older men looking at children inappropriately, and then you have, you know, the natural kind of cattiness that comes between girls naturally, you know what I mean? So it's like I'm absorbing the fact that like I'm gonna have a daughter who's gonna have enough challenges as it is without having to worry about like, hey, and there's a serial killer out there. You know
what I mean? Right. It's already hard enough being a woman in today's society with all these like social norms and what people think that women are supposed to be. And, you know, I hope that one day the world just wakes up and is like, we don't have to do this.
Yeah.
And I want to say whoever the first woman is that shaved her legs, dang you.
Woman, whoa, man. That's but... No, it's it's definitely, I know it's, I have an air of privilege that, you know, I know I can walk through a parking lot late at night and not be as concerned about my well-being.
Not looking over your shoulder every 2 seconds, making sure that every noise you hear isn't a person following you close behind you, checking under the cars to make sure nobody's under your car, parking your car under a lighted spot so that you know that you might be safe.
Right.
Those kind of things.
Well, and you know, like I'm wearing a Cash Rules Everything Around Me t-shirt in gym shorts right now. And I went to Publix today and nobody was like,
nobody
dress nicer. You know what I mean? Like smile more, baby. You know what I mean? So, you know, I like I said, I think part of just being a father, especially to a girl, is just like, you, especially nowadays, you have to realize those things and like be prepared to have those conversations about those things. And like I said, that's enough on its own without having to be like, yeah, and there's a guy out there just targeting women of multiple different ages and just, you know,
go on and buy her first pepper spray. It's fine. Yeah,
I can't. No, if I just, okay. So I gave her an old Sony CyberShot digital camera. So it's a camera from like 2004, 2005.
I have my pink one. It's coming back, baby. That pink digital camera is coming back.
Yeah. I gave it to her so she could, because she likes taking pictures. Mm-hmm. And she came up to me. She goes, this is a camera from back in the day. She said, this is like from the 90s. And I was like, no, it definitely isn't. But even with that camera, since I've given it to her for the last like 3 days, there's just constantly been a camera like in my face, like an inch away from my face. So I can't imagine giving her pepper spray. That's it. Like the whole house would just be in tears. All of us would be sprayed.
Okay, so, maybe in a few years.
Yeah, it's going to be a minute. But my mother-in-law listens to this podcast, and I swear to God, she buys pepper spray in bulk. I've gone to her house, and she's had like 8 of them wrapped. And she's like, here, you take one and you take one.
But I don't know anybody who's ever actually used it.
Yeah, I do know. So shout out to my wife's aunt who had one that looked like a little bottle of perfume. It was supposed to be incognito. And she was cleaning out a drawer and found it. And she was like, oh, look at this perfume. And so she did that thing where you spray it in front of you and then you walk into
sniff,
it.
Yeah.
And she straight up pepper sprayed herself like in her bedroom. She just walked into a cloud. No.
My nursing school classmate, she had one time. So we sprayed it out in the parking lot just to like spray it. Because we were like, we just got to know how to like spray the thing. So we sprayed it, but like nothing happened.
Kara's high school that she went to. Apparently there was lots of fights in the cafeteria and the SRO officers would come in. If you got into a fight, they would just pepper spray you. So they would see two people get into a fight. They would see the SRO's officers run in and they would be like, run. Or else if you were in the cafeteria, you were getting, pepper sprayed. And she was like, yeah, it happened like five, six times where like my eyes are just watering. Cause you're on the out, like the outer ring.
Yeah.
You're just like, But yeah, all that to say, you know, Kara had a taser for a really long time. I'm sure we have pepper spray in this house somewhere, but it's definitely not going to the six-year-old.
Not yet.
Well, that is where we fall on the deadbolt test for this week's case. Olivia and I are both coming in at a 9, but as always, we want to hear from you, the listeners, the locksmiths. Where does Sean Vincent Gillis fall on your deadbolt test? You can let us know. Reach out to us on Instagram at Check the Locks Pod. You can find us on Twitter at Check the Locks. And if you're not in our Facebook group, what the heck are you doing? Come hang out with us. We'd love to get to know you, hear what you think about the cases, just spend a little time with you. And as always, if you like what we do, you want to help financially support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron. Head over to patreon.com/checkthelocks and get signed up today. Got a lot of great tiers, exclusive benefits. You get stickers, coffee mugs, stuff like that. Plus, you get the episodes commercial free. So if you love Check the Locks, but you hate those ads, Patreon is the way to go. So again, you want to throw us a couple bucks, help us keep the lights on. That is patreon.com/checkthelocks. Get signed up today. And if you can't financially support the show, we definitely understand. Just listening, hanging out with us, sharing what we do with your friends and family, the people who are important to you, means just as much, if not more. So if that is you, you're listening, you're telling people to check it out, you're sending those links, just know we appreciate it so much. That's how we're going to grow, bring new listeners into the family, and really, again, just extend our community. So if you're letting people know about the podcast, just know that we appreciate you more than we could ever tell you. That's all that we have for this week's case, but please make sure that you're subscribed to Check the Locks on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. We will see you again next week with another truly terrifying true crime case, but until then, don't forget to
check the locks.
See you next week.